Waves lap on the shore of the small coastal town of Cahersaveen in County Kerry. It is a cool spring day, the 16th of April, 1984. It is a Monday, around 4 p.m. Local school children, Boy Scouts and Girl Guides line the approach to the town cemetery. It's a small graveyard overlooking the wild Atlantic Ocean. Gusty winds whip in off the sea. The children form a choir, singing religious hymns as the local undertaker, Tom Cornan, passes through the crowd carrying a tiny white coffin. It is barely larger than a shoebox. In that tiny coffin lies the body of a baby boy. Last night, Tom slept in the funeral home, alongside the baby in his tiny coffin. He didn't want him to be alone. The infant's body was found lying on the cold sand of the nearby White Strand beach just 2 days ago. Tom had gone to the beach after the terrible discovery was made. He had performed a simple open-air christening of the baby. He used fresh water from a nearby stream and named the unknown baby. He called him John. They will call him Baby John, but nobody knows his real name. Nobody knows who his parents are, or how he ended up on that remote beach in West Kerry. They will not know for many decades. But the search to find out will become one of Ireland's most infamous and controversial criminal investigations, and a series of events that had a profound impact on Irish society. In the small Holy Cross Cemetery in Cahersaveen on that cool spring day, prayers are said and a simple cross is placed on the infant's grave. It's inscribed with the words, "I am the Kerry baby, baptised on the 14th of the 4th, 1984, named John. I forgive." When someone is killed in Ireland, the Gardaí call in a specialist unit of forensic crime scene examiners from the Technical Bureau. This is Ireland's real-life version of CSI, but it's nothing like the movies or TV shows. For 25 years, I was one of the detectives on that team. My name is John Sweetman. My job as a Garda detective in the Technical Bureau was to read the evidence that could not speak for itself. I learned to see what others might miss. Fingerprints smudged on a handle of a door. Weapons disguised in everyday objects. Handwritten notes that revealed more than the writer ever intended. The smallest traces often unraveled the big story. And now, I'm here to tell you those stories. In this podcast from Go Loud, I take you inside some of Ireland's most haunting investigations. This is Lines of Inquiry, a Go Loud original podcast that follows the evidence step by step and tries to uncover the real story behind the headlines. In this episode, we examine the case of the Kerry babies, two tragically short lives whose untimely deaths had long-lasting impacts on the social fabric of the Irish nation. There were few people on White Strand Beach in Cahersaveen on Saturday evening, the 14th of April, 1984. It had been abnormally warm that year, with record-setting temperatures across the country. But by 8 o'clock, the light was beginning to fade, and John Griffin had the beach almost to himself. John liked to keep fit, and was an active member of the local athletics club. That evening, he jogged between the rocks on the hard sand where the sea met the shore. Something pink caught his eye, over to his right. He kept running. He thought it was a doll. Curiosity then got the better of him, so he turned back for a closer look. It was face down, but the dark hair was too realistic to be a doll. This was the body of a very small child. John blessed himself. He didn't want to touch the infant, but he had to raise the alarm. He sprinted for 2 miles until he arrived to his brother-in-law's house. His wife's 18-year-old nephew, Brendan, was outside fixing up a car. Together, they drove back to the beach. It was dark when they arrived. By the low light of the moon, they could just about make out the shape of a tiny child lying face down next to a rocky outcrop. Beside the remains were 3 grey fertilizer bags. Brendan reached down and turned the baby around, lifting its face off the sand. They alerted the local Garda station, who dispatched Garda Pat Collins to the scene. It was dark. Garda Collins shone a torch onto the beach and across the body of the small infant. The light illuminated 2 black marks on the baby's back. Garda Collins contacted his sergeant, Patrick Reedy, who made his way to White Strand Beach. Along the way, he picked up the local undertaker, Tom Cornan. Tom and his wife, Kit, were sitting down for the evening, waiting for the Late Late Show to come on, when the sergeant knocked at the door. Tom had a vehicle which served as an ambulance, and together they removed the baby from the rocks, wrapped him in a small piece of white sheeting, and placed the remains on a stretcher. Slowly and somberly, they drove away from the beach. A short distance away, Tom pulled the ambulance to a gentle halt on the corner of the road. It was next to a small, fast-flowing mountain stream. Tom Cornan took the tiny body in one arm and knelt beside the gushing fresh water. Scooping up some of the icy mountain water in his spare hand, he placed a few drops on the baby's forehead. Then, in a steady voice, he said, "I baptize thee in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. I call thee John." Baptism was the only Catholic sacrament which can be administered by a layperson. A baby which died without being baptized could not be buried in consecrated ground and were not believed to go to heaven. By blessing baby John, Tom Cornan had saved him from an eternity spent in limbo and a secretive, shameful burial on the fringes of the graveyard. Not long after their brief pause, they arrived at Cornan's funeral home. As they examined the body of baby John, it became clear that the cuts and bruises on the infant's body were deep. They looked unlikely to have been caused by friction with the rocks on White Strand Beach. Sergeant Reedy made some calls, and it was agreed that the state pathologist, Dr. John Harbison, would carry out a post-mortem the next day at a hospital in Killarney. Tom Cornan decided not to take the hearse. Instead, he placed the small coffin on the back seat of his car for the hour-long journey along the scenic Ring of Kerry. The examination began at midday. It took 4 hours for the horror of baby John's death to become fully apparent. When he first began, Dr. Harbison thought perhaps the injuries had come from prawns or crabs, but it soon became clear that these were stab wounds, 28 in total, all into the front, including 2 directly into the chest. There were multiple other wounds. It appeared the baby's killer had panicked and frenzied. His neck was broken. The umbilical cord had been cut so tightly, it was flush with the skin. This stood out. Normally, an inch or two of the cord is left to allow it to be clamped. It was apparent that the baby's body had also been washed after birth. His lungs had fully expanded to allow him to breathe on his own. Dr. Harbison estimated that the baby had been born 3 or 4 days earlier and had lived for 1 day, maybe 2 at most. For the undertaker and the Garda sergeant, Dr. Harbison's findings were a shock, perhaps unlike anything else they had come across in their careers. Tom Cornan began planning for a Christian burial of baby John the next day. But when he brought the body back to the funeral home, he found himself unable to return to his house. After all baby John had been through, he didn't deserve to be alone through the night. And so, On the Sunday night before the burial, Tom slept in the funeral home, close to the child. In 1984, Ireland was staunchly Catholic. 90% of people went to Mass weekly. Divorce was illegal, and the belief that sex was for marriage was widely held. Contraception was only available by prescription, and over two-thirds of people voted in favour of a constitutional prohibition of abortion. To have a baby outside of the sanctity of marriage was highly stigmatised and considered an incredible shame. Unmarried pregnant women were sent away by their families to mother and baby homes run by religious orders. There, secluded from society, mothers would be subject to neglect and both emotional and physical abuse. Many of the babies didn't survive. The mortality rate of an infant born in the homes was 15%, double the national average. If it survived, the baby would be put up for adoption without consent. Those who escaped this fate suffered their own consequences. Eileen Flynn made headlines early in 1984 after losing two appeals for unfair dismissal from her job as a teacher in Holy Faith Convent in New Ross, County Wexford. She had fallen pregnant by a married man. The story of 15-year-old Anne Lovett, who died at a grotto in Granard, County Longford, after giving birth to a stillborn baby, sent shockwaves across the country that are still being felt today. In Cahersaveen, with a population of just under 1,500, news about the stabbed baby spread quickly. Local Gardaí were looking for leads from any quarter. Men and women in relationships that were outside the mainstream were the initial focus of their attention. People having affairs, local hippies enjoying an alternative lifestyle on Ireland's Atlantic coast, travelling families and people just passing through were all spoken to and ruled out of the investigation. Teenagers and young women were questioned about their relationships and intimacy. Large jumpers, baggy enough to have concealed a pregnancy, were trendy at the time. Now parents were afraid of what might have been hidden underneath. Priests made appeals from the pulpit for anyone with information to come forward, while a gravedigger at the cemetery where baby John had been laid to rest discreetly kept watch on the grave in case the infant's mother approached the spot. Local Gardaí were in need of support. This was a case unlike any other they had worked on. They called for detectives from the Garda Murder Squad to come down from Dublin. They were the elite grouping of detectives within An Garda Síochána, charged with investigating the most serious crimes. They were highly regarded due to their record of successful investigations, although there had been allegations against some of the squad of brutality towards suspects, including confessions coerced through violence. Six detectives from the murder squad arrived, led by a Kerry man, Superintendent John Courtney. Courtney briefed his team along with Gardaí from other stations. He mistakenly told them that the baby had been stabbed in the back. Gardaí expanded the search beyond Cahersaveen. A local Garda sergeant made three phone calls and within just 90 minutes had a lead the investigators would pursue from that point on. He spoke with contacts he had in a Catholic organisation called Cura, which worked to help unmarried mothers. The group had representatives working in Tralee Hospital. They reported to the Garda sergeant that there had been three unmarried mothers attending the maternity ward around the time of the discovery of the baby on Cahersaveen Beach. One in particular they felt could be of interest. Her name was Joanne Hayes. 24-year-old Joanne was a single mother of one. These days, such a status would pass unnoticed. But in the mid-1980s, this label was a judgment in the coded language of the time. It was a comment on her sexual behaviour. Gardaí learned that Joanne had an affair with a married man, Jeremiah Locke. He worked with Joanne at a sports centre in Tralee. He had been married for 4 years and had two young children. Jeremiah and Joanne were lovers and had a daughter named Yvonne, who was approaching her first birthday. Joanne had been in the maternity ward on Saturday, the 14th of April, the same day that baby John's remains had been found on White Strand Beach. Her medical file contained the words scan and uterus recently emptied. Doctors believed she had recently given birth, but there was no baby to be accounted for. Had she been the mother of baby John? Joanne lived with her family in Abbeydorney, a small rural community of less than 200 families, some 80 kilometres from the beach at Cahersaveen. While the location was far from the crime scene, it was at that point the only lead in the investigation. Detectives gathered in Tralee Garda Station and agreed on a plan of action. Nobody was to be arrested. Instead, persons of interest would be asked to assist Gardaí with their inquiries. Around midday on the 1st of May 1984, detectives pulled into the yard of the Hayes family farm in Abbeydorney. At the same time, in the nearby town of Tralee, they arrived at the leisure centre while Joanne was working. Gardaí brought Joanne to the station for questioning. As they drove along in the squad car, they asked Joanne about her farm, how much land they had and how many cattle. When she arrived, she was brought into a large room with a row of chairs lined up by the window, the chief superintendent's office. Joanne looked out the window and saw her brothers, Ned and Mike, being brought in. Her sister Kathleen and her aunt, also Kathleen, had also been brought in. Garda Maloney, who worked in Abbeydorney, joined her. Garda Maloney knew Joanne. When her daughter Yvonne was born almost a year earlier, there was a run-in with Jeremiah's extended family. Garda Maloney had warned Joanne to stop seeing him. Joanne was convinced that her lover would leave his wife and set up home with her. She got pregnant again, but when she realised that Locke's wife was also pregnant, events came to a head and the affair reached its end. There was to be no happy ever after. Joanne, who was heartbroken and ashamed, had not discussed her latest pregnancy with her mother and siblings. Garda Maloney asked her if she had read about the baby that was found in Cahersaveen. When she told him she had, he replied, "That is your baby, Joanne." Superintendent Courtney of the murder squad stopped by the room briefly. He pointed a finger to Joanne's shoulder and told her to tell the truth and not be covering up for anyone. Joanne was terrified by his brief visit. Joanne denied having any connection to the baby found in Cahersaveen. She told Gardaí that she had delivered a baby boy at home on Thursday, the 12th of April, the day before the body of the Cahersaveen baby was discovered. She had given birth standing up in a field and torn the umbilical cord herself. But it was a stillbirth. Her baby was dead. Joanne said she had panicked and buried her baby at home. She told Gardaí she had nothing to do with the death of the baby found on Cahersaveen Beach. The Gardaí told her it was impossible to have delivered her baby standing up and that they did not believe her. Murder Squad detectives, Detective Jerry O'Carroll and PJ Brown, took over the questioning and sat down in front of Joanne Hayes, introducing themselves to her. Joanne was crying when they arrived. She had lost track of time. Detective O'Carroll reassured Joanne that she would not go to jail if she told the truth. Joanne said repeatedly that she had given birth alone and that the baby had died. She wrapped the infant in a brown paper bag and left it in a pool of water. She drew a rough map which pinpointed the spot, saying, "My baby is 200 yards from my back door." She offered to show exactly where the infant's remains could be found, in the corner of a field, but was told by Detective O'Carroll that she would not make a fool of them. O'Carroll would later say that he had approached John Courtney, the head of the murder squad, with Joanne's map, the drawing that showed the location of the child's body. Gardaí searched the outside area of the Hayes farm, but failed to find a body. Then they looked inside the farmhouse, but again, no remains were found. After the search party found nothing, O'Carroll claimed he asked Courtney to let him take Joanne Hayes with him to search, but he was prevented from doing so. Joanne had given birth, but no baby could be found. Connecting these two facts, investigators were convinced that Joanne was the perpetrator of the Cahir Savine baby's murder. Jeremiah Locke, the father of Joanne's baby, had also been brought in for questioning. He insisted he knew nothing about the Cahir Savine baby, but understood that Joanne had lost their baby in hospital some days earlier. It was clear to detectives that Jeremiah Locke was not a suspect. Before he was released, the door to the interview room was opened briefly, and Jeremiah heard a scream. He wasn't sure if it was from a man or a woman, and he wondered if it was Joanne. Detectives continued to question Joanne, insisting that she was the mother of baby John. Then Detective Brown began to read from his notebook, a statement signed by Joanne's brother Ned. Ned was 27 at the time, a sociable young man who was popular in local GAA circles. As she listened to the statement that Ned had signed, Joanne thought she might be sick. It said that Joanne had stabbed her baby in the chest. The baby had then been placed in a fertilizer bag, similar to the ones found next to the stabbed baby in Cahir Savine. Then he had driven to Slay Head, a spit of land reaching into the Atlantic Ocean further north of Cahir Savine. There he had thrown the bag, with the body of the baby inside, into the sea below. This information now connected Joanne Hayes with the Cahir Savine murder. Next to sign a confession was Mike Hayes, Joanne's older brother. This story was slightly different. It stated that his sister Kathleen produced a bathroom brush and a kitchen knife. These were given to Joanne, whom he claimed stabbed her baby and beat his body with the brush. Then the body was placed in a bag before he and his brother drove to Dingle. Joanne's older sister Kathleen, after initially denying any involvement, later signed a statement. In it were details about Joanne giving birth at home and requesting a carving knife which Kathleen gave to her. Kathleen said Joanne then stabbed the baby about 6 or 7 times. This was claimed to have occurred in the early hours of Friday morning, the 13th of April, 1984, with Joanne's mother, brother Mike, and Aunt Bridie all allegedly present for the stabbing. Then in some detail, Kathleen's statement outlined how the baby was wrapped in a plastic bag before she and her two brothers got into their blue Ford Fiesta. Her statement said they drove through the night to a spot past Dingle where the road runs beside the sea. It claimed it was Ned Hayes who threw the body into the sea. Joanne's aunt, Bridie Fuller, also signed a confession that night. This statement claimed that Joanne had a baby at home and that the baby had subsequently died. When these details were put to Joanne, she insisted she didn't remember any of what was described. Detectives told her she must have blacked out. A distressed Joanne agreed to sign a new statement. It told in detail a story of her baby's death, of hitting the baby with a bat brush, of stabbing it with a carving knife multiple times in the back, and how the baby stopped crying. By way of explanation, Joanne's statement said she, quote, had to kill him because of the shame it was going to bring on the family. The statement went on to detail how her brothers had placed the baby's small body in a plastic bag and then drove away in the family car. The document ended with the words, when the body of the baby was found in Cahir Savine, I knew deep down it was my baby. I was going to call him Shane. It also included an apology. The statements all implicated Joanne Hayes, describing in detail how she had stabbed her baby. There were inconsistencies, including who exactly had been present when the body of the baby had allegedly been tossed into the sea, but Gardaí believed the central information was clear. Joanne Hayes had delivered a baby, a boy. She had used a carving knife to stab the infant to death, while her brothers and possibly her sister had driven to a spot close to Cahir Savine to dump the baby's body into the sea. Shortly after 10 p.m, several members of the Hayes family were brought before the local peace commissioner to face charges. Joanne faced the most serious charge, that of murder. The other family members who were to be charged faced serious but lesser charges, namely helping to dispose of a body and concealment of a birth. As her family prepared to leave, Joanne, who would spend the night in a cell, stood near her sister Kathleen. The two spoke lowly, so as not to attract the attention of the Gardaí at the desk. Just 24 hours after being charged, the phone in Tralee Garda Station rang. Joanne's sister Kathleen was on the other end. After returning home to Abbeydorney, she and her brothers had gone out onto the land. Joanne had told Kathleen where the baby was. They followed the instructions she had given them, down past the bedstead gate and into the field beyond. As they searched for the body of Joanne's baby in the fields, they spotted something in a ditch. Kathleen told the guard on the other end of the line that they had located the body of the infant. The Garda who took the call didn't believe her at first, but after referring the matter to his superiors, four officers were dispatched to the farm. Beyond a small fence was the pond that Joanne had described, and next to it, by some bushes, lay the body of a tiny baby boy. By the first week of May 1984, Joanne Hayes' already difficult life had fallen apart. She was in Limerick prison, facing a murder charge and potentially a prison sentence for life. Four of her family members were also facing very serious criminal charges, having confessed to the involvement in the death of baby John. With the discovery of the remains of a second baby on the Hayes family farm in Abbeydorney, it appeared Joanne had been telling the truth when she insisted she was not the mother of baby John, whose body was found on the beach in Cahersaveen. So how was it that Joanne Hayes had confessed to the murder of a child that was not her own? And how did four of her family members sign statements, declaring themselves to be accessories to that murder? Gardaí had a serious problem. Joanne and the Hayes family believed a blood test could provide answers. If it could be proven that she was indeed the mother of the baby found on her family farm in Abbeydorney, as she had stated at the outset, and not the mother of the stabbed baby John, then that should clear her name. On the 3rd of May, Dr. John Harbison began an examination of the baby found in Abbeydorney. Tests on the body of the Abbeydorney farm baby revealed that the baby had been born at full term and weighed roughly 5 pounds. There was some light bruising on the body, which could have been consistent with the baby having been delivered by his mother, as Joanne had claimed. There was no evidence of strangulation, and crucially, there were no stab wounds. Clues about the infant's parentage were limited. This was many years before DNA technology was refined, and investigators had to rely on the four human blood groups, A, B, AB, and O. Your blood type is determined by your parents. From them, you may inherit tiny proteins in your blood, known as antigens. You might have A antigens, B antigens, or both, leading to type A, B, or AB blood. Blood that doesn't contain any of these antigens is known as type O. If both parents are type O, they don't have any antigens to pass down, and so their child will be born with type O blood as well. Forensic scientists conducted tests on blood from the remains of the baby found on the Hayes family farm. The tests showed that the baby had blood type O, the same as both Joanne Hayes and the baby's father, Jeremiah Locke. The baby on the Cahersaveen beach had blood group A, so even if Joanne Hayes had given birth to the child, it would have been medically impossible for Jeremiah Locke to have fathered both infants. The discovery of the second baby, the medical evidence from the child's body, and the Hayes family confessions now left just two possibilities. Either Joanne had given birth to twins, or the signed statements from the Hayes family were false. The Gardaí then had to consider how best to proceed. Rather than drop the charges against Joanne and the Hayes family in light of the new evidence, a new theory began to gain traction among the investigating team. The answer, according to investigators, lay in a word that most had not heard before or since. Superfecundation. They asked, could Joanne Hayes have given birth to twins, with the twins having separate fathers? Could it be possible that she carried two children at the same time, fathered by men with two different blood groups? For this to happen, she would have to have had sex with her lover, Jeremiah Locke, blood group O, and then also had sex with an unidentified man, whose blood contained these antigens. This unidentified man would have been the father of baby John, the Cahir-Savin baby. A green mattress recovered from Joanne's bedroom was inscribed with the name Tom Flynn. The Gardaí considered the possibility that he had been her second lover. This theory relied on what is known as superfecundation, a phenomenon where two or more eggs are fertilized by sperm from two different males. It's common in some species of animals like rabbits, rats, and cows, but in humans it is extremely rare. In fact, there are only about 10 confirmed cases of it occurring naturally. This theory of superfecundation was to be the theory Gardaí pursued as an explanation for the two dead babies, and to explain their claim that Joanne Hayes was the mother and killer of both. Gardaí argued that Joanne had indeed been the mother of both children, and after stabbing baby John, her brother Ned had disposed of the infant by throwing his body, concealed in a bag, into the sea off Slay Head. The tides had then carried it across the bay to Cahir-Savin. This story matched the details in the Hayes family confessions, and regardless of its reliance on a series of highly unlikely events, from the vast distance the body may have travelled in the sea, to the theory of two fathers for one set of twins, Gardaí insisted that this was the scenario to explain the sequence of terrible events. Joanne Hayes was granted bail on the 10th of May. She was given a voucher for the bus. As she got on board, she worried that the conductor might start asking her embarrassing questions and that the other passengers would overhear their conversation. To Joanne's relief, the conductor didn't mention her voucher. Weeks turned to months, and by the autumn, it was clear to the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions that the chances of a successful prosecution were dwindling by the day. There were tense meetings between investigative Gardaí, who were keen to pursue the case, and the state solicitor for Kerry, who had deep reservations. The final decision on whether or not to proceed fell to the Director of Public Prosecutions, the DPP. On September 20th, 1984, a senior legal assistant to the DPP, Simon P. O'Leary, wrote a letter where he discussed the case, calling it amazing. In the letter, O'Leary pointed out that you could not possibly run a prosecution on this evidence. At Tralee Courthouse on the 10th of October 1984, almost exactly 6 months after the births of the two Kerry babies, the DPP ordered that the case be struck out. Charges against Joanne and the other Hayes family members were all dropped. 3 days later, Joanne's face appeared on the front of the Irish Independent, smiling with her daughter Yvonne. Her story was told across pages in national newspapers that weekend. On the 16th of October 1984, the matter of the Kerry babies reached the centre of public attention when RTE's flagship television current affairs programme, Today Tonight, began reporting on the story. The show's producer was Barry O'Halloran, and he later wrote a book about the case, called Lost Innocence. Today Tonight interviewed Joanne Hayes and her family in their simple country kitchen. The slight young woman, dressed in a black and white jumper, spoke in a small voice with her strong West Kerry accent. Her words carried great weight and a serious accusation. Joanne said her confession had been coerced by Gardaí. She said she had only signed the statements because Gardaí threatened they would charge her mother with murder. Joanne said Gardaí threatened to place her daughter in an orphanage, and they told her they would make sure the family farm was sold. With her words going out across the country on TV, Joanne Hayes went far further than retracting her original confession. They were explosive allegations, and a claim of Gardaí going far beyond the line of what anyone could argue was acceptable police work. Joanne's claims were backed up by her family, who had all given statements in the Garda station in the early days of the case, confessing to taking part in the cover-up of Joanne's killing of her newborn baby. That broadcast of the Today Tonight programme did more than simply report on an emerging scandal. It shaped future events. As word spread of the tragic but bizarre case in rural Kerry, journalists and others began to ask how all of this had come to pass. How had a family seemingly confessed to a horrific crime in significant detail, if they did not commit it? People began to ask what had gone on during the Garda investigation. The Irish Council for Civil Liberties expressed concerns about the case. Journalists like Nell McCafferty saw in the case a clear picture of Irish male attitudes towards women at a time of rapid social change in Ireland. An internal Garda inquiry was launched to look into the reasons why investigators persisted with the case against members of the Hayes family. The family members wanted assurances that they would be immune from prosecution if they agreed to talk to the internal Garda inquiry. They failed to receive these assurances, so they submitted written statements instead, supported by their solicitor, Pat Mann. Several Gardaí also involved in the investigation only gave limited support to the internal inquiry. In the end, the internal Garda inquiry achieved little. Crucially, it failed to explain how Hayes family members had confessed to involvement in a murder which they clearly didn't commit. It soon became clear that there would be no answers forthcoming. The public continued to demand answers, and so, 3 weeks before Christmas in 1984, the Minister for Justice, Michael Noonan, announced that there would be a public tribunal of inquiry, with Justice Kevin Lynch presiding. At the outset, the stated purpose of the tribunal was to discover what happened when the Hayes family was questioned by Gardaí, and if it should have happened. Justice Lynch's job was to untangle the story and establish the facts of the case. He was specifically to uncover the circumstances that led to criminal charges being brought against members of the Hayes family, and to consider the allegations made by the family about how their statements were obtained. The judge's final job was to make sense of all these facts and to produce a report. The work of the Kerry Babies Tribunal began on the 7th of January 1985. It was scheduled to last 3 weeks. It would go on for 5 months. The expectation from many, from the public to the media, was that the focus was to be on the conduct of the Gardaí. In his opening address, Mr. Justice Lynch said that the tribunal was similar to a civil action by the Hayes family against the guards. This turned the tribunal from a fact-finding mission to a confrontation, with the Hayes family on one side facing the institution of An Garda Síochána and a group of their detectives. The tribunal was also given scope to inquire into what was termed any relevant matters. This broad remit allowed the legal teams and the judge to take the tribunal in any direction they deemed relevant. This allowed the judge or barristers to return to the theory put forward by the prosecuting Gardaí, the theory of superfecundation, the theory that Joanne Hayes had given birth to twins fathered by two separate men. This theory had previously been dismissed and discounted by the DPP. However, the tribunal could now revisit it. The tribunal took place behind the stony grey walls of Tralee Courthouse, in a large room with high ceilings and heavy drapes. First to give evidence to the tribunal were the women closest to Joanne Hayes. They were all asked variations of the same two questions. Did they know that Joanne had been pregnant? They did. And did she lie to them in saying that she had had a miscarriage in hospital? Again, the answer was yes. This line of questioning was designed to weaken the credibility of Joanne as a truthful witness. Among the tense, dark atmosphere of the proceedings, there were some lighter moments. The same women were asked if they knew a certain Tom Flynn. Barristers told the tribunal that the name Tom Flynn had been written on Joanne's mattress at the Abbeydorney farm. One barrister suggested that Tom Flynn had been Joanne's second lover. The insinuation was that Tom Flynn may have been the father of Joanne's second baby, a claim that would have given credence to the Garda superfecundation theory. Outside the court and inside the public gallery, local men sported T-shirts with the words, "I'm Tom Flynn," emblazoned on them. It took weeks for the truth to emerge. Tom Flynn was revealed to be a local mattress salesman who took such pride in his work that he placed his name on each mattress he sold. He left Kerry for America in 1969, never to return. That was when Joanne Hayes was just 10 years old. Tom Flynn was never spoken of again. Joanne Hayes' lover, Jeremiah Locke, took the stand on the 9th of January 1985. The packed public gallery hushed as the young man rose to give his evidence about his affair with Joanne. At 5'2", Locke was a small man who introduced himself as a married man with two children. But he didn't include his third child, 18-month-old Yvonne, his baby daughter he fathered with Joanne. This omission of Yvonne was not challenged. The focus of questioning to Locke moved quickly from whether he was in love with his wife into the details of his sexual relationship with Joanne. Senior counsel Martin Kennedy, representing the Gardaí, asked Locke where, how often, and when they had sex together. Was it in his house when his wife was away, or was it in his car parked on the side of the road? Locke admitted that they had sex in his car, a Mini, on evenings when he gave Joanne lifts home from work. He was shown an ordnance survey map and asked to pinpoint the exact places where the couple had sexual relations in the Mini. Later, barristers asked Locke who had instigated the intimacy, the man or the woman. "It takes two," was Locke's considered reply. Another barrister asked Locke if they had used contraceptives, then a restricted item in Irish pharmacies. They hadn't, Locke said. The barrister wanted to know, was Joanne Hayes a virgin when they met? Locke said she wasn't. A Catholic priest was so incensed by the intimate and personal questions asked of Jeremiah Locke that he went on national radio to protest. Father Paul Byrne of the Conference of Major Religious Superiors was outraged that Locke was asked by lawyers whether he had used contraceptives, an act which was deemed a sin at the time. But most observers felt that Jeremiah Locke's questioning was low-key when compared to the cross-examination of his lover, who took to the stand on the 16th of January 1985. Joanne Hayes was a slight woman, barely reaching 5 foot, even in high heels, with a distinctly 1980s-style perm. On the seventh day of the tribunal, dressed in grey trousers and a black-and-white jumper, she walked through the towering crowds of Gardaí with her head held high and her back straight to take the witness seat. It was a tall mahogany chair, and Joanne's feet didn't reach the ground. She was visibly nervous, clasping her hands together as she faced a succession of male lawyers and experts. The crowded gallery was full with spectators and watching media. At 2:29 p.m. the questioning began. Joanne spoke about her family and her early years. Then barristers asked Joanne about her affair with Jeremiah Locke. She looked down. Her voice began to waver. She raised her head briefly as she replied, "I just happened to fall in love with him." As barristers questioned Joanne about subjects normally only discussed behind closed doors, her face, clear of any makeup, grew flushed. Barristers cross-examined Joanne extensively about her sexual history and contraceptive use. The tribunal heard of the dates and times of her menstrual flow since 1982, including the detail of a miscarriage she had suffered in June of that year, after becoming pregnant by Jeremiah Locke for the first time. Joanne was brought in again the next day for further questioning. She wound a tissue around her hands nervously, drinking so much water that a jug was produced for her. She was pale and wept openly in court. For 4 hours she faced questions about her relationship and the statement she gave to Gardaí. The next day, Joanne sat holding a holy medal as she faced further questions for another 9 hours. Multiple times on the stand, Joanne Hayes broke down. She struggled for breath, sobbing as the 5 all-male legal teams took turns to cross-examine her. The mindset of this single mother was analysed in detail by 2 psychiatrists. Lawyers for the Gardaí presented details on the width of her uterus after she gave birth to her first child, Yvonne. The hearing was told personal details of the suturing she received after giving birth, as well as the state of her vulva and breasts as they were in April 1984. On the 4th day, while denying having stabbed baby John, Joanne broke down and ran from the courtroom. Counsel for the Hayes family implored Mr. Justice Lynch that his client was under great stress. The judge replied that she had to do the best she could. He granted Joanne permission to go to the toilet. When she returned, a doctor told the judge that she had been shaking, vomiting and hyperventilating, so he had sedated her. One of those watching this unfold was journalist Nell McCafferty, who was seated in the section of the courthouse reserved for reporters. She heard Joanne in the corridor, retching and crying. She watched in horror as Joanne returned to the stand so heavily sedated that her head bobbed off the microphone many times. Nell would later speak of her regret that she didn't stand up and call out the spectacle that they were all witnessing. She felt the treatment of Joanne was not only grotesque, but most probably illegal. Nell would say she had felt intimidated at the time, as had many others in the courtroom. In all, Joanne Hayes was asked over 2,000 questions over 5 days. The longest questioning at any court proceeding in the history of the Irish state. As the proceedings unfolded and reports emerged from what was happening inside the courtroom, public opinion began to turn against the tribunal and the treatment of the Hayes family. Many ordinary Irish people turned up outside the courthouse protesting. Joanne's neighbours, mostly male farmers, made signs that read, "Abby Dorney supports Joanne," and carried them the 4 miles to Tralee, standing outside the courthouse in the cold January morning for hours. On Wednesday the 20th of January, a woman named Bernie McCarthy listened to a report on the radio about the proceedings at the courthouse and the treatment of Joanne Hayes. Bernie decided she had heard enough. She called into a small flower shop in the town with very specific instructions. Bernie told the florist to select a single yellow flower, wrap it in cellophane, attach a note of support, and hand-deliver it to Joanne Hayes in Tralee Courthouse. Later that morning, 2 other women did likewise. When Joanne Hayes emerged from the courthouse that lunchtime into a barrage of photographers' flashbulbs, she was carrying 3 yellow flowers. In the days that followed, dozens more yellow flowers were sent to Joanne, and quickly, those dozens became hundreds. Others sent mass cards and letters of support. Many of the people who wrote those letters told Joanne their own stories. Stories of life as a woman in a deeply conservative nation. Stories of unplanned pregnancies, family secrets, and lonely abortion journeys to England. Many wrote of how they believed Ireland could do far better than this. In the Dáil, TDs raised concerns, calling the questioning of witnesses harrowing, quite horrific, and very, very frightening. The numbers of protesters gathered to support Joanne Hayes grew to upwards of 250 people. Mr. Justice Lynch had to be escorted by Gardaí when leaving the court. He referred to the protests as grossly improper. Observers noted that the 15 legal men on the case were just that. Men. There were no women judges, barristers or solicitors. So when the women of the Hayes family took the stand, Their cross-examination involving the most intimate matters of a woman's sexual being was conducted by men. The atmosphere and language used was adversarial, and not just from the legal representatives for either side. At one point, Justice Kevin Lynch, overseeing the tribunal, described Joanne Hayes as the wrongdoer. Joanne told the court how she had been shouted at repeatedly, threatened and refused permission to use the toilet, and told to get sick on the floor. Her sister, Kathleen, recounted how she had been slapped 5 or 6 times on the back of the head before giving her inaccurate statement to the detectives. Ned Hayes told the tribunal how he was punched, pulled by the hair and knocked off his chair, and Michael Hayes spoke about having his jacket pulled and being forced to walk around the room. Yet it felt to some that rather than being an inquiry into the Garda investigation that had been promised and hoped for, this was in fact the trial of Joanne Hayes and her family, the trial that the DPP had refused to authorise. Lawyers for the Gardaí doubled down on the super-fecundation theory, the idea that Joanne had given birth to twins by 2 separate fathers. On the 9th of May, 72 days into the tribunal, an expert witness from the University of London was called by the Gardaí to testify on their behalf. Dr. Patrick Lincoln was a senior lecturer in blood group serology. Dr. Lincoln reminded the hearing that the stabbed baby found in Cahersaveen, baby John, was blood type A, and that Joanne Hayes was blood type O. He said he examined a sample of Joanne's blood and found no evidence that she had given birth to a type A baby. If she had, type A markers in her blood would have remained, and there were none. Joanne Hayes, he declared, did not deliver a type A baby, and therefore did not deliver baby John. Regarding the notion of superfecundation, Dr. Lincoln said such a case was so exceedingly rare that one ruled it out. As Dr. Patrick Lincoln's evidence came to an end, so too did any talk of superfecundation. It was never mentioned again. After 72 days, his testimony finally dispatched the notion of superfecundation. Piece by piece, the Garda case was falling apart. At one point, a pathologist gave evidence about the blood from the stabbed baby. A suggestion was put forward that somehow the type A blood sample from the infant had become contaminated, and in fact it was really type O, but the experts couldn't agree on this. Professor John Harbison told the tribunal how he was unable to determine a cause of death for the baby found in Abbeydorney, and expressed doubts as to whether the baby had ever taken a breath. When asked about the bath brush mentioned in Joanne's statement, Professor Harbison took the brush and recreated the blow. He explained to the tribunal how this would have caused a fracture to the skull that wasn't present. Another theory Gardaí considered was that there was a third baby, which became known as the Azores baby. The suggestion was that Joanne had given birth to twins. One was the baby found on Abbeydorney Farm. The other, the Azores baby, was allegedly stabbed by Joanne, and this body disposed of in the manner described by the members of the Hayes family in their statements. Under this theory, the Cahersaveen Beach baby was unrelated to Joanne or the Azores baby. With no meaningful evidence to support this theory, it too was set aside. One of the last to give evidence was Superintendent John Courtney, who had led the investigation. He had listened to the evidence from Joanne Hayes and her family members. He heard the words of Jeremiah Locke, watched the notion of superfecundation come and go, heard about the Azores baby, blood contamination and other theories. Superintendent Courtney told the tribunal that despite the evidence heard, he still believed that Joanne Hayes had delivered twins, and crucially, that the statements made by the Hayes family were spontaneous, voluntary and independent. He insisted that there was no threat, inducement or promises made to the Hayes family and denied that any abuse had occurred. When asked directly if he had pulled Michael Hayes' jacket, as had been claimed, Courtney replied, "I certainly didn't lay a hand on him the whole afternoon." After 82 days, 109 witnesses, and over 61,000 questions, the Kerry Babies Tribunal came to an end on the 14th of June 1985. There was no jury, just a single judge presiding. Members of the Gardaí or the Hayes family could not be found guilty of any offence, and no punishment could be delivered. Its remit was simply to deliver facts and explanations. 4 months later, the waiting was over. The tribunal report was finally published. The Kerry Babies case is, in part, about events, but ultimately, it's about people. Joanne Hayes, the young woman who confessed to a murder she didn't commit. Her family, who also made false confessions. Joanne's lover, Jeremiah Locke, and his family. The Gardaí who investigated the case. The all-male legal teams at the tribunal. The reporters who told the world about what was happening in a remote part of Ireland's Atlantic coast. And the two infants, Shane and John, who, unknowingly, in their desperately short lives, created a space where a nation could question its values and adopt new ones. But those times were still far away when the Kerry Babies Tribunal report was published in October 1985. Many expected harsh criticism of the Garda teams involved in questioning the Hayes family. Instead, the focus was on Joanne, a forensic public shaming of both her and the Hayes family. In his summary of the report, the respected Irish sociologist Tom Inglis made it clear that Mr. Justice Lynch had declared the Hayes family to be perjurers and liars. More importantly, he stated, in effect, that Joanne Hayes was also reported to have been responsible for the death of her baby. Although the state pathologist's report showed no evidence of this, Justice Lynch's report stated that she had struck her baby with a bat brush to make sure that he was dead. He said that in order to protect their honour and good name, and to avoid the shame of having done away with a newborn child, the family deliberately lied to their neighbours and friends. It was a mixture of their guilty consciences about what had happened to Joanne Hayes's baby, and a willingness to help the Gardaí with their inquiries, that they had lied and made up stories which would link them to the murder of the Cathair Savine baby. Justice Lynch stated that the investigation had been, at times, slipshod, but did not accept allegations of intimidation, abuse or assault. The report, in the main, exonerated the Gardaí. Joanne Hayes did attempt to tell her side of the story, on her own terms, in a book released in 1985, called simply My Story. It was published by Brandon Books, a well-respected independent Irish publisher based in Dingle, County Kerry. After it was released, three of the investigative Gardaí on the case took an action against her in the High Court, claiming libel. They received an out-of-court settlement estimated to be more than €100,000, along with an unreserved apology. Any remaining copies of My Story by Joanne Hayes were shredded and pulped. The impact of the tribunal and the public reaction lingered in Ireland and inspired change. Contraception became fully legal in 1993. No doctor's prescription was required, and condoms were made widely available, irrespective of age or marital status. In 1996, the Irish people voted in a referendum to allow divorce. Later, in 2015, a marriage equality referendum was passed. Another watershed moment came 3 years later, when Irish voters repealed the 8th Amendment to the Constitution, which had outlawed abortion in almost all circumstances. A much more liberal abortion law followed. In the decades that followed the Kerry Babies case, Ireland elected three women as president, something that would have been unimaginable in the 1980s. The Kerry Babies case never fully went away, and many Irish people, including those who subsequently came to power, believed that Joanne and the Hayes family had been harshly treated by the tribunal and deserved better. In 2004, on the 21st anniversary of baby John, the headstone was completely destroyed by a sledgehammer. It was replaced by the undertaker, Tom Kernan. This time, Tom excluded the final words from the original inscription. "I forgive." He no longer felt it was his place to forgive. There was no meaningful DNA testing in the 1980s, but by the early 2000s, this technology had advanced and was, year by year, becoming an increasingly important investigative tool. In 2004, Joanne Hayes, speaking through her solicitors, said that she would welcome DNA testing to definitively prove that she was not the mother of baby John, the Cahir-Savine stabbed baby. A DNA profile of the baby was finally generated in 2018, using a sample kept from the original post-mortem examination. On the 16th of January 2018, 34 years after baby John was found, on Garda Síochána held a press conference. Superintendent Flor Murphy told waiting media that it had been confirmed that Joanne Hayes was not the mother of baby John. He apologised to Joanne for the stress and pain she suffered and for the shortcomings in the initial investigation, and reassured the public that a new investigation would be thorough and professional. The following day, the then Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, delivered a press conference. He made an apology on behalf of the Irish state. Varadkar highlighted that he himself had little memory of the events for which he was apologising. His words reflected a sense of national shame and also of embarrassment at the length of time this apology had taken. 34 long years. Slowly and deliberately, the Taoiseach described this case as eye-opening and singled out a woman who he described as having been, quote, "badly treated by our state and by our society, in a way that so many other women had been in the past." And he said, "this needed to change." Subsequently, Joanne Hayes and her siblings all received compensation from the state. The exact amount was not formally published, but the offer is understood to be that Joanne Hayes was allocated around 1.5 million euro, her three siblings, 300,000 euro each, and her daughter, 100,000 euro as compensation. A cold case review followed, and in September 2021, Gardaí exhumed the baby's remains at Holy Cross Cemetery in Cahir-Savine, and DNA samples were taken for analysis. Baby John's body was then reinterred at his resting place. In March 2023, Gardaí investigating the murder of the infant arrested a couple in their late 50s and early 60s at a location in South Kerry. The man and woman were questioned for 24 hours before being released without charge. DNA results confirmed that the couple arrested are the parents of the Beach baby. It's now down to the Director of Public Prosecutions, the DPP, to decide whether anyone is to be charged in relation to the baby's death. Joanne Hayes is now in her mid-60s. She still lives in Kerry and maintains a dignified silence by refusing all requests for interviews. In all these years, her stance as a very private person has remained unchanged. Indeed, an internet image search for her photo today only reveals pictures taken in the mid-1980s. She keeps herself to herself, and despite becoming an unlikely hero for Irish women, never saw herself as an active feminist. Nonetheless, Joanne became a symbol of many of the things that were wrong with Ireland at the time, in particular the dominance of the Catholic Church and the moral doctrines that went with it. She was an unmarried mother. It wasn't a badge that she carried with either honour or shame. She just was. Her case allowed for a very public questioning of the treatment of unmarried mothers in Irish society. No longer was saying nothing the only option. Things had to change. And, in part thanks to Joanne Hayes, they did. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of Lines of Inquiry. If you're enjoying the podcast, leaving a rating or review really helps. We've now passed 5,000 five-star ratings on Spotify, along with a growing number of reviews on Apple Podcasts. Those reviews make a real difference and help new listeners find the series. Make sure you like and subscribe to the podcast to get notified whenever a new episode is released. If you're listening on Spotify, you can also leave a comment on this episode. We read every comment and we're genuinely grateful for the time you take to share your thoughts. You can get in touch with us directly by emailing linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com if you have a question or a case you'd like us to cover. We'd love to hear from you. Follow us on Instagram at Lines of Inquiry Podcast, and if you can, share the podcast with others. Lines of Inquiry is presented by me, John Sweetman. The podcast is created by Darren Cleary. Our executive producer is Owen Brennan. Our producers are Siobhan Walsh and Aoife Plunkett. This episode was written by David Malone and edited by Siobhan Walsh and Owen Brennan. Sound design and editing by Neil Kavanagh, with legal, marketing and social media support from the team at Go Loud. Sources for this episode include The Irish Times, RTE, BBC, Irish Examiner, Irish Independent, Crime and Confessions, My Story by Joanne Hayes, A Woman to Blame, The Kerry Babies Case by Nell McCafferty, Truth, Power and Lies, Irish Society and the Case of the Kerry Babies by Tom Inglis. Join me next time as we open another case and follow the evidence wherever it leads. Because, in the end, everything done in the dark comes to light.